Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Guest today on Church and Culture is Mark Melcher, longtime friend of mine, who is president and editor of the Political Forum. Mark Melcher has followed global and domestic social and political trends from Washington for the financial community since 1973, when he joined the Washington Forum, a subsidiary of Drexel Burnham Lambert. He left Drexel in 1983 to open a Washington research office for Prudential, and he ran the Prudential Washington research office for 17 years until the year 2000. During that time, he won the first place prize in the Washington research category of Institutional Investors Annual All-American Research Team. I hope he got a trophy. And in each of the 8 years, that category was in existence. I assume it is no more. Shortly after leaving Prudential, Mark joined the Washington Research Office of Lehman Brothers, and he left there in 2002 to found the Political Forum. Mark has written a book along with his partner, Stephen Socup, and we're going to be talking about that book in this show. Mark, welcome to Church and Culture.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here with you, Dale.
Well, I'm pleased too. And you and I have shared a lot of fun together and a lot of other things together over the years, and it's nice to have you on the show. Now, you have written a book with Stephen. Is it actually in print yet? I have a PDF copy.
No, it's not in print yet. It should be out, I'm hoping, within the next month. It's ready to go. They're designing the cover.
Okay. Well, the book is entitled Know Thine Enemy, A History of the Left. And it's going to be coming out from Covenant Books, I assume, next 6 weeks. It's a big book. I've read most of it that I could read in the past 4 hours. And I think I get it. Now, is this book really going to be nearly 1,000 pages long?
Yes.
And do you apologize for that?
I said it didn't start out that way, but that's the way it ended. I've been working. My partner and I have been working on it for 10 years. It's a labor of love more than anything else.
Well, 10 years. Okay, we'll cut you slack on 10 years. But having, you know, read a lot of it, I can say that you really, it needed to be a long book because you started from the early part of the 18th century where you talk about the birth of the left, and you bring it all the way through the present day, and you don't skip a single person who needed to be mentioned. They are all there, your cast of characters.
No, thank you, Dale.
Now, why did you and Stephen spend 10 years writing this book? What drove you?
I've been writing about basically the left and the ills and the sins of the left since I joined Drexel Burnham years ago. At one point, the reason I, for what it's worth, the reason I was fired from credential is because I did that too much, and the liberals in New Jersey didn't like it.
Well, that's automatic. Everybody's going to buy your book for that.
Yes. But, anyway, then I don't know how much personal you want in this.
I want a lot of personal. Our listeners like that.
Well, my wife died 10 years ago, and that was a terrible shock to me. And I began, what I do all my life is write. So I started writing on the book and with writing and researching and reading. And it's been a wonderful, it's been a lot of fun. And I think, as I said, the book is a labor of love.
And how did you and Stephen share the load?
Well, all the time that this is going on, Steve and I are running the political forum,
right?
Which we publish a weekly newsletter for investors, basically the large institutional investment community. And so, Steve, I quit writing the newsletter,
the day-to-day of
it. Taking responsibility for writing the newsletter every week.
Yeah.
And I started writing the book, and we traded back and forth for 10 years. Mostly, you know, I write, and he edits, and then he writes, and I edit. And with different chapters, of course. He's like a son to me. We've been known each other for years, and it's been 20-some years, we've never had a dispute. Which is very
funny. Are you sure you ever talk to each other?
Yes. Well, that's an interesting relationship between editor and writer, and we both play, wear the hat.
That's got to be a kind of world record, as far as I can tell.
Well, he's a brilliant young man. He truly is. He's very smart. I'd be very lucky to find him, and we've had a good relationship over the years.
Well, again, I want to tell our listeners that your book, Know Thine Enemy, A History of the Left, and by this you mean left in the largest sense, not just but ideological, moral, spiritual, you know, you've got everything in there, which is appropriate.
Yeah. And I don't know if you've noticed, but in the book, we've concluded that the left died in the mid, basically.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, but since you've brought it up, that's one place where I kind of went, what? The left still seems to be around to me.
Well,
so what's your argument there?
Well, all of the iterations of the left started out as two, basically two goals. One is to destroy Christianity, which they contended was based on superstition, and to replace it with reason. That came out
their version of reason.
Yes. Well,
I mean, their version of reason is not the reason of Thomas Aquinas or Aristotle.
And that became quite a problem for them.
Yeah, yeah.
In that there's no foundation for reason, as there is with the transcendent beliefs. And the second one was to create a new order to replace Christianity, again, based on reason. So there are basically two elements. Destroy Christianity because it was responsible, in their view, for all of the world's ills, and that, by the way, of course, comes from Rousseau.
Yeah, why'd you say the left is dead?
Okay, here's the principle is this. All of the iterations of the left were aimed at creating a new social order that would be better than the existing social order. Somewhere around probably the 60s, they stopped pretending that they were creating a new order. Marx was going to create the workers' paradise, if you recall. Nazi Germany was going to create a Aryan nation. Some of the leftist iterations talked about the entire world was going to be a better place. Others talked about just like Nazi Germany, just our society, but they all promised a wonderland, a better world, truly better world, where private property, you know, and, well, you get the point. They stopped that. You don't hear that anymore.
You hear echoes of it.
You hear echoes of it, but that's propaganda. They don't have a blueprint for a better world.
They don't believe the idea of an earthly paradise anymore?
No. The eschaton is gone. You listen to these people, what they do is they hate Trump. They're not sure why they hate him, but they hate him. But this happened, of course, in the 60s, and if you go back to Lukacs, to the Frankfurt School, to Lukacs and that crowd, they actually said...
Now, our listeners may not be familiar with the Frankfurt School or George Lukacs or any of the leaders of that, Walter Benjamin and so forth. So you might explain it to them.
What happened over the years, the leftist dream of a paradise, of a better world, began to disintegrate. Marxism was kind of the blueprint. It ended up as being the blueprint upon it, which everyone built their ideal world. But slowly,
then you had the names of Horkheimer and Adorno pop up.
Yeah, well, Horkheimer and Adorno, they came to the United States with the idea of basically advancing Marxism. Marxism by that time was dead in Europe. The Marxism died when basically Hitler came to power. And
De Gaulle is really the one who killed Marxism in France, where it nearly took over the government after World War II.
Right, well, but When Lenin came in, Lenin had hoped to, after the war, to create, after the World War One, to create a revolution in Germany, a Marxist revolution in Germany. And the problem in Germany for them was they had two factions, Marxist factions, couldn't get along, and Hitler came in and basically stole the show.
Okay, so Marxism is dead, and the Frankfurt School rises, Horkheimer, Adorno, Benjamin, and others. And what ideas did they bring to the States with them?
Well, the idea they brought here was to basically sell Marxism in the United States.
Under a different, under a disguise?
No, they came in with... and perhaps we should go in some sort of lineal order, but they basically bought the Gramsci plan. We should go into Antonio Gramsci.
Yeah, let's start with Gramsci, the Italian nihilist.
Yeah.
Tell us about him.
Gramsci was a communist, an Italian communist. When Mussolini broke away from the Communist Party, based on whether or not they should go to war in World War One, as you recall, the Communist International had wanted no worker to participate in that capitalist war. Mussolini decided he broke from communism because of that, to defend Italy. And he went after the communists. He wasn't a Marxist, and he started his own fascism. And Gramsci was in his way, and he put him in prison. The judge at the time said, we need to stop this man's brain from working, and they threw Gramsci in. He's a little...
What is a Gramscian, then? What ideas illustrate Gramsci and his approach?
Gramsci sat in prison for years in Italy, and he smuggled out his views. And what he did, he began his project by questioning why Marx's revolution didn't occur. Why, if we all love Marx so much, why didn't we ever have the revolution of the proletariat? He concluded that Christianity was the culprit, that the glue that the glue between the proletariat and the work and the owners, the factory owners, the bourgeoisie, was Christianity. And he said, we have to destroy Christianity. We have to give up the idea of a revolution.
But all the previous revolutionaries going back to the early Enlightenment were trying to do the same thing, as you say in your book.
Yes, but Gramsci's idea was this. The way we have to kill Christianity is we have to take over the institutions. We have to take over the newspapers. We have to take over the radios. We have to take over the schools, the universities. And that's what they've done.
There was an institutional project
yes.
to get at
long,
the sources of education,
large.
Culture,
yeah.
taste, attitude,
right.
emotion, and so forth.
Long,
so how does that lead into the Frankfurt School?
Well, Lukács was familiar with Gramsci, and Lukács, well, and Borkenheimer, and that crowd, and they knew. But, of course, Gramsci was in prison. He couldn't do it, so they decided to do it.
Well, he died in 37.
Lukács.
No, Gramsci.
Gramsci, yeah, he died in prison. He never got out.
So he's even though his ideas are alive, he's way out of the way by the you know.
Oh,
by
yeah.
the post-war period.
I don't think he ever got out of prison. He was a little hunchbacked fellow, and
well, don't hold that against him.
No, but he was. Yes, we can't all be handsome.
I noticed that you have a tendency to kind of pin things on your enemies list here. Hume was fat. Others hung out with loose women. You don't really find many redeeming characters in a lot of your enemies. Know thine enemy, and you have a lot of enemies.
Hume was fat.
Well, he was, and he admitted it. That's true. Corpulent. No, you said corpulent.
Corpulent, yes.
Yes. So, again, did Frankenheimer and Adorno simply extend this notion? Did they extend this notion of taking over institutions? Is that what they did?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, yes. But here's the thing, if I can find it. Frankenheimer, they concluded, and this is what this is, of course, Marcuse was the father of the New Left. He came from that.
Well, he sat in an American university in a tenured chair for many, many
yes.
years.
They all went into education. Now, here's Horkheimer. He said, the situation is hopeless for socialism. He actually says this. The employed are too comfortable. The unemployed are too scatterbrained. The social democrats are too wishy-washy. The communists are too obediently following authority, and the national socialists are undiscussable. That's the
Nazis. Well, he was right about all that.
Absolutely. And so what they did, they gave up the first part of the blueprint, which was the second part of the blueprint, which was to create a perfect society, and settled in on the other part, which was to destroy Christianity.
Well, they took a long-term approach, which was to get at the foundations of Western civilization.
Absolutely, based on Gramsci's blueprint. But they gave up the idea of selling Marxism. They actually, he came right out and said it doesn't work. And
Since we've sort of started with Gramsci, let's go backwards now. Because, you know, preceding Gramsci, there are a variety of characters. Let's go down the German road, because you start the German part of the story with Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, and you bring that forward through a variety of characters, Fichte, Schelling, especially Hegel, is at right at the crossroads of everything, and then Nietzsche. Can you talk a little bit, Hegel seems to play a crucial role in this story, especially with his influence on Marx, his influence on Lenin, and his influence on Woodrow Wilson, who read Hegel a lot in college. Tell us about Hegel.
Well, The funny thing about the interesting thing about Hegel is you can almost anything you say about Hegel is in other words, everyone can have a different opinion of Hegel because he was so vague, no one understood what he said even at the time.
Well, he said a lot of things differently at different times of his life.
Yeah, and some of it incomprehensible. But he came up with...
Not if you're a Hegel scholar, Mark. But I agree, it's incomprehensible even to the average intelligent reader.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah. Actually, I've got a couple quotes in the book from
I saw those. I saw those.
And they said, you know, that he was incomprehensible, so that everybody could make up their own.
But he wrote in German. Everyone who writes in German has that problem. Go ahead. Why is Hegel the river that feeds the tributaries of all these other people?
Marx liked Hegel for a couple of reasons. One of them, it was his view of basically the Superman. He said, well, let's start first with history. He said history is moving. He was a historicist who believed that history was moving in a pre-established way he didn't get specific as to the end, which marks, where it was going. And I think that had to do a little bit with he maintained that he was a Christian.
Well, Hegel collapsed the Holy Spirit part of the Trinity into history.
Mm-hmm.
History became a spiritual process by which a people through the state defined its character, defined its nationhood. And so in that sense, the state became the vehicle for the spiritual, quote-unquote, efforts of the people.
Now, the problem with Marxism, Marx said the same thing. We're moving toward, a Marxist society where there'll be no government, no private property, everyone will be... So basically, who was it? Vogelin called it the immanentization of the eschaton.
Yeah.
In other words, you immanentize.
The great Erich Vogelin is one of the great, I think, commentators of the post-war period. He also described this as a kind of Gnosticism.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Gnostic. So, but Marx liked the idea, Hegel didn't say where it was going, because as a Christian, or as a purported Christian, it had to be going toward the return of Christ, and he didn't want to get involved in that, so he didn't really say where this historicism was leading, and that allowed Marx to make up his own end.
He called it the absolute spirit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's as vague as you can get. I agree.
One of the funniest things, though, about Marx in this question was if historicism is really true, and if history is moving to a predetermined endpoint, then why do you need the revolution?
I don't think it was predetermined in the strict sense.
Marx came up with a solution to that problem. He said, we have to help with the birth pangs.
Yeah, well, they certainly did.
He was helping with the birth pangs of this new world. But of course, Marxism shouldn't ever have been taken seriously. It was contrary to human nature.
Tell us what is it? What's contrary to human nature about Marxism, Leninism, and Wilsonianism? What's contrary to human nature there?
Well, relative to human nature, let's put all leftist constructs, starting with, even before Marxism, but starting with Marxism, are based on the contention that, Rousseau's contention that original sin is bogus. That there is, man does not have a propensity to evil. That's not true. All all men come from God perfect, and it's the society that it causes all the troubles. In Rousseau's case, the French revolutionaries took that to mean we have to get rid of the church, we have to get rid of the king, we have to get rid of the nobility. But it's part of all of the leftist constructs that you can, in fact, create a perfect world if you just do it right, which is still today. You see it with the left in the United States, or what purports to be the left. If we could just have a national health insurance, we could just do this, we could just do this. It's contrary to human nature if you, as the poet Auden said, he said, whether you believe in the poetic truth of original sin or if you believe in the story itself, it's still true.
Yeah, and
so Marxism,
the issue there was, as a politician or a moralist or even as a parent, do you approach the education and formation of people with the assumption that you just need to get out of the way and let the goodness of nature take its course? That's one. That's Rousseau's assumption. The other is that there is a natural inclination towards selfishness and pride,
mm-hmm.
and you have to educate on that assumption, which is the Christian assumption.
Yes, and that's also Aristotle's. Aristotle used the phrase, I think, if you look to, C.S. Lewis's, what's the most, Something of Man?
The Tao.
Anyway, he said that the little human animal has to be taught right from wrong.
Well, he said, his point's different, though. He says that a human being is brought into existence with a bundle of potentialities. Those are neutral. You have to habituate them into virtue, not vice. Which is closer to Christianity than Rousseau.
Oh, absolutely. Rousseau is one of the.
I spent the night in his house.
Really?
A year or two ago. Yeah, in Versailles. Very pretty place. I didn't come across any of his bastard children or any of his mistresses while I was there.
He wrote about, of course, Emile was about how to raise a child, and he apparently took three or four of his own children to the orphanage.
No, he took all of them. All of them.
Yeah, well, then
all of his bastard children were immediately taken to orphanages.
Yes, very, very bad.
You have sort of several moments of real that you underscore of great importance, and obviously the French Revolution is one of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What role does that play in the creation of the left?
Well, that's Rousseau. Rousseau's contention on original sin. And Voltaire's attack on the church, both came out of the French Revolution. They destroyed the French society and then failed to be able to do what they had intended to do, which was to build a better society on top of that one, based on reason.
And of course, a bloodbath ensued. We're going to talk about that bloodbath, which is a chapter of Mark and Stephen's book, Know Thine Enemies, after this brief message.
Rising high school juniors and seniors, college seniors and graduates, you're invited to the Ave Summerfest Thursday, June 14th at the Ann Arbor residence of Tom Monahan. Learn about the generous Ave Maria University of Michigan scholarship of $28,000 over 4 years and the generous Ave Maria School of Law Michigan Toledo full tuition scholarship. Meet admission counselors, students, and alumni. This event is free with registration at AveMariaFoundation.org by June 8th. That's AveMariaFoundation.org.
Since its inception, Arbor Woman has been embracing life, empowering women, and promoting wellness. You're invited to join Arbor Woman as they honor their foundational roots and becoming the first in Michigan to transition from pregnancy center to a woman's medical clinic. Their 10th anniversary dinner, auction, and celebration is Thursday, June 7th in Ann Arbor. RSVP by May 20th to arborwoman.com. That's arborwoman.com.
Are you tired of how your faith is represented in the mainstream media? Stop getting your Catholic news from secular sources and get it from a trusted, local Catholic source instead. At the Michigan Catholic Newspaper, we're Catholic, and we cover your Catholic Church in a way that only Catholics could. So the same reason you listen to Ave Maria Radio, get the Michigan Catholic for only $24 a year by calling 313-224-8000 or visit themichigancatholic.org.
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
We're talking about the book he co-authored with Stephen Sukup entitled Know Thine Enemy, A History of the Left. It will be out in print very soon after you've heard this interview. Mark, why is it that something like the French Revolution, which was actually was greeted with celebration by, for example, the English Romantic poets, and as you mentioned, Shelley, Wordsworth, they all had a revolutionary streak themselves. Why did it descend so quickly into this tyranny, this bloodbath that you describe in your book?
Well, I think it exists today. I mean, it's the attitude that led to that exists today, and that is the French revolutionaries believed that they were absolutely right, that Rousseau was absolutely right, and that we could, in fact, create a better world, and that any the end justified the means. Any horror, any violation against God and man that had to occur in order to reach this eschaton, this earthly eschaton, was just part of what we had to do. We have Danton, I believe it was Danton, who said, these priests have done no wrong, but they must die.
You're talking about Jeremy Bentham?
No, Danton, D-A-N-T-O-N.
Oh, Danton.
I think.
Danton.
Danton, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliantly played by Gerard Depardieu in a film entitled Danton. And they did slaughter thousands of priests, but then thousands of priests also joined up in the revolution.
Well, yes.
And a lot of priests, they joined up and they remained priests, but many just took off their priestly vestments and became lay people and married nuns. Nuns the same way, but I would say more were slaughtered or exiled or just simply escaped than actually came around. I think the overall percentage is something like 40% went with the revolution, 60% didn't.
I actually have a little frame in my office of a very tiny little piece of paper called an assignat. And it's an original. You can buy it for $30. They're not anything. But the French post-revolution, they didn't have any money. So what they did is they sold shares in the church property.
Right.
Called assignats. And it was one of the first fraudulent princes, because the first problem was they didn't know how much the property was worth, so they just kept printing assignats until nobody wanted them anymore.
Now, would you, I think you, as you described it with the French Revolution, I mean, this was one of the first times the left had political success, so to speak. Brought down a king, beheaded him and his wife, took over all the institutions, confiscated all the land that would belong to the church and so forth. Is it the case that these political successes of the left end up in the same kind of evolution into tyranny as the French Revolution?
Oh, absolutely, because it goes back to these priests must die. They stand in the way, and anything, any nightmare or horror or whatever it is, it's okay because this is predestined, and our goal is a better world.
Well, I'm thinking of what happened when Lenin took over the Russian Revolution.
Stalin.
He took it away from Kerensky. I'm thinking of Mao's takeover of the, and I'm thinking, you know, you go to any, what about Castro? You go to any leftist slash Marxist slash communist takeover, there's not a single one that hasn't resulted in a tyranny and with death and imprisonment and torture for many without trial, without the ability to defend themselves.
Right. I run a fairly long speech by Robespierre in there, which could have been borrowed by any one of the men you mentioned. It was all filled with glorious what we're going to do and how wonderful we are, how virtuous we are, and we're going to kill all the people that get in the way of our virtue. It's kind of an amazing thing, but it's intrinsic to the left because the left has basically, I'll go off the cushion for just a minute, but you know, the left still uses, or I'll still call them the left, but they aren't really the left, but we'll turn the left. They still use the language of morality. They say this is
moral. Oh, absolutely.
Moral.
They do.
And
I mean, look at global warming, right?
Exactly.
Look at immigration. But it's all clothed. In morality.
Use the terms, but they have the word to them means nothing because they don't believe in God.
No, it means whatever they want it to mean in order to maintain power. It's a matter of maintaining power.
Yes. Alistair McIntyre said what happens is that moral now means this is, I think this is good.
You know? Well, it means this is what I prefer. You know, not what is right. Necessarily, because there is no right.
Mm-hmm.
It's my preference.
And that's, you know, Nietzsche said God was dead, but then Horkheimer. Anyway, I'm having trouble with the names.
Well, there's so many names in your book. I'm having trouble with them too. But some of them are quite fascinating. And so, if we move forward, then. From the French Revolution, what was it about, you know, a few decades earlier, the American Revolution had taken place?
Yes, exactly.
How was it the American Revolution escaped being turning into a tyranny?
Well, because they were Christians, and they came here for Christian, you know, for the purpose of practicing their Christianity. You know.
Does that make them natural conservatives?
Oh, absolutely.
No. Oh, good. I'm glad you said that.
But what happened, and this is not widely known, but we had what do they call it? The first, revival. What did they call the first?
Oh, you're talking about the Methodist revival down in Georgia?
Yeah, the first one.
The first Great Awakening.
Great Awakening.
The
second Great Awakening is where the left got a foothold in America before the European left even got here. This is interesting. The second gospel, there was the social gospel movement, and a big...
But that didn't come until after World War One.
No, no, no. It was before World War One. Richard Ely was a professor at the University of Wisconsin, and he taught Wilson and he taught Teddy Roosevelt.
This would have been the 1880s then.
Yes.
Or 70s. Or 70s, yeah. Okay.
Right. And Richard Ely was a big wheel in the social gospel movement, and he came up with the idea that the Catholics took years to come around to because I always have liberation theology. He basically introduced liberation theology in the United States in the early part of the 20th century.
Well,
and here's what
just a second, let's clarify something. Liberation theology had an explicit devotion to Marxist ideas.
Yes. Here's what Richard Ely said. God works through the state to carry out his purposes.
That's Hegel. That's pure Hegel.
Exactly.
Pure Hegel.
Back from Hegel. He was a Hegelian.
Yeah.
God works through the states to carry out his purposes more universally than through any other institution. Christianity is not Christianity at all. And that started the Protestant denominations into works, into basically the Mann Act, right? The
one that excluded Catholics.
Yes, all of that stuff was to help. Basically, that was the introduction, and in the book I go to where Ely got that. He got it from one of the conferences in Europe about, what the Protestants were trying to draw up. I don't have it in front of me, but it's in the book. And so you have this whole social gospel movement, and today you find the Methodist Church and the Lutheran.
Yeah, but, I mean, there are a lot of steps between...
Oh, absolutely.
That time, I mean, you can draw a line, but it really didn't get its roots down
to
the
60s. Had a huge influence on Wilson. That's the point.
And the creation of the World Council of Churches.
Absolutely, yes. And that was Richard Ely. He also started the American Economic Society. He had studied under Schmaller in Germany, who was Bismarck's socialist. And he came here and attacked laissez-faire economics and won. Richard Ely's a real bad guy.
Well, he is.
So your
point is that a certain form of leftist ideology made its way to the United States through religion.
Yes, absolutely. Through the Protestant movement, the social gospel. The idea that, that the church, the institution, should be involved in this. I would have argued that individual Christians should do that, and they can organize within the church to do it. But the church's job is to save souls.
Well, that's another program. And the left infiltrates, but they're through religion, but they're followed by the left taking over the academy.
Then we had the Civil War and the Industrial Revolution here, which required labor. And the country was flooded with Germans, Frenchmen, people who came in, and they brought... Well, actually, the Second International, Marx had moved the head of the International to New York to get him away from the anarchists. And so he already had the International located in New York, and basically they started forming unions, leftist unions. Now, interestingly, our two major union organizations I forget what they're called. I don't have it in front of me, but they were very anti-socialist.
Well, they were Catholic. They were very staunch Catholics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
You know, you had unions dominated by Irish Catholics. You had some
exactly.
Italian, Eastern Europe. I mean, one of the great tragedies in this country is that, you know, the takeover of the unions by the left. You know,
yes.
Just as you're talking
exactly.
about.
Yeah. So, but the left had a foothold here from the social gospel, and then they came streaming in shortly after the Civil War, and found a home.
Well, of course, slavery was a perfect opportunity, right?
Mm-hmm.
For them.
Yep,
I mean, that gave them cover. I mean, obviously, it was an issue that needed to be addressed. But oftentimes, you know, people borrow on one issue in order to get another one on the table.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So coming forward, you paint portraits of presidents, but I believe you think the worst one of all was Woodrow Wilson. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes. Wilson was, he was a Hegelian, very strongly Hegelian.
Meaning by that, history is really where God works.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And he was also arrogant enough to say that the Constitution was outdated and had to be updated.
Well, he wanted a much stronger executive. He didn't want to have to worry about what Congress thought.
Exactly, yes. And he also decided that we should have a one-world government.
That's what he pushed toward. That's what his League of Nations was.
Right, which was, as always, I don't like it against human nature again, but the idea, if you can't even get, you know, agreement within a small community, you're not going to organize the entire world unless you could tyrannize. It'd have to be an amazing tyranny. It wouldn't work.
No, I mean, the major players at the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, you know, David Lloyd George, Clemenceau, and the, mm-hmm. I forget the name of the Italian, they were all laughing at Wilson. They were just
yes.
playing along with support for the League of Nations in order to get the territories they wanted.
Exactly. Clemenceau said, Lloyd George, it was interviewed about that, and he said, I think I did all right, given that I was seated between Jesus Christ and Napoleon.
Well, Clemenceau is a warrior all from World War I. He understood human nature. He got it. And David Lloyd George is a brilliant, don't you think, a brilliant and realistic
Absolutely.
Man.
Yes, yes. He said, I was seated between Jesus Christ and Napoleon.
But you, by the way, though, you reserve your Pythias title for FDR. You call it FDR Useful Idiot.
Well, he was.
You don't think that's a little strong, Mark?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Look at what he said about... He actually, at one point, I think he was a duke. In other words, yeah, a useful idiot. He actually, at one quote in my book, and it comes from a good source, he said that he thought everyone but him misunderstood Stalin. He said something to the effect that Stalin conducted himself like a Christian gentleman. I mean, he wanted Stalin to be something he wasn't.
So did Churchill.
Well, Churchill was a little smarter. Churchill just wanted to preserve the
Churchill,
empire. And
Churchill should have smelled him out sooner than he did. But
yes,
And Truman, did Truman continue Roosevelt's mistakes?
I think my view on Truman, reading a lot about him, was that he was trying to protect the Democratic Party from the from its close from Roosevelt's closeness to from Roosevelt's mistakes. He was, if we had known then, if the public had known then, like what came out in the Verona papers, the closeness, the spies within the government,
Remind our listeners what that is. Remind our listeners what that is.
Well, the Verona papers came out. We were intercepting all the Russian communications, but we weren't translating them because they were a friend, and they didn't think that that was, you know, a priority. After the war, someone sat down and started translating them and found out the extent of the Russian connections with the Roosevelt administration were just frightening, unbelievable. All the way, well, White, you know, what the heck was White's first name? He was a big shot in the Treasury, and Acheson, all of those guys. Some of them were actual spies, and some of them were complicit. And Truman was trying to protect that, trying to keep that from getting out. He built himself as an anti-communist, and I think he was, but he didn't want, he went to great lengths to protect the Democratic Party, the people, keep people from finding out how complicit the Democratic Party was in communism in the United States.
Now, this making Roosevelt and Truman part of your story about the history of the left, is this simply to underscore the way in which religion has lost its foothold, the way in which the power of the state has increased? Are these the kind of themes you're thinking about?
Yeah, it was the power of the state. Mostly, every war increases the power of the state.
Right.
There are endless. Actually, the founding fathers knew this too.
And it never goes back to where it was.
Exactly. Yes.
Right.
And of course, we have the CIA. And the CIA, I don't know. I have good friends who work at the CIA. Some of them, you know, substantial. But the original CIA, run by Dulles' brother, they were running around the world doing things that were just unconscious. I can't pronounce that word. Unconscionable. Right?
Well, yeah.
Overthrowing governments and with no understanding of secondary or even tertiary consequences.
We have a few minutes left, Mark. Talk about the impact of the left on religion in America.
Well, they're winning. I mean, it saddens me to say this, but their Western civilization is getting. Europe is post-Christian. I mean, you know, you hear that all the time, and we're facing the same fate.
Yes, Mark, I agree, and I think your book, Know Thine Enemies, The History of the Left, illustrates beautifully how the loss of faith, and you do quote the great Dover Beach of Matthew Arnold on that issue of the loss of faith, illustrates it very well, and I think readers will really appreciate this rather epic job you and Stephen Sukep have done. So I want to thank you for being on Church and Culture. But tell our readers how they'll be able to buy your book when it's ready in a matter of weeks.
Well, it will be on Amazon, and there will be an e-edition that you can, you know, buy it for on Kindle. And I'm, as I say, we're dealing with the cover right now, and I don't know exactly when they'll be out, but it'll be on Amazon, and it will be available in an e-book.
I would suggest the e-book. It's going to be a big book otherwise, but but big books deserve beautiful covers, so wait till you get what you like. And thanks again for being on Church and Culture, Mark Melcher.
Oh, Teal, thank you so much. I appreciate it very much, and I'll see you soon.
You got it. And to all of you who are listening, I'll be back in a moment with another wonderful guest.